Freeth understood her son's feelings. "Leet, I can see that you need to leave this place for a time." The young man nodded, thinking of the long trek down to the south polar regions. "It would be best if I devote myself to other work." He volunteered to deliver the next spice bribe to Rondo Tuic, an arduous journey that few others undertook willingly. "It is said that echoes are not only heard by the ears," Freeth said. "Echoes of memory are heard with the heart." Smiling, his mother placed a lean hand on his shoulder. "Go where you must. I will explain everything to your father." Leet said his farewells to the Siege, to Warwick and Ferula. The other freemen could sense his disquiet and his restlessness. "The son of Omakynes wishes to go on a Hajj," they said, treating his journey as if it were some holy pilgrimage. And perhaps it was a kind of vision quest, a search for inner peace and purpose. Without Ferula, he needed to find another obsession that would drive him. He had lived in the shadow of Pardet Kynes all his life. The planetologist had trained Leet to be his successor. But the young man had never scrutinized his heart to determine if that was a path he wanted to take. Young Freeman men often chose the profession of their fathers, but that was not carved in stone. The dream of reawakening Dune was a powerful one that inspired and required intense passions. Even without his 19-year-old son, Omakynes had his devoted lieutenants Stilgar, Turok, and Amun, as well as the secondary leaders. The dream would not die, no matter what Leet decided. He could be in charge of them some day, but only if he threw himself wholeheartedly into the problem. "I will go away and try to understand the purpose that burns in the heart of my father." He had decided to go back to Dominic Vernius. With the Freeman ability to retrace footsteps across rugged or featureless ground, Leet Kynes stared at the Antarctic wilderness. He had already delivered his cargo of distilled spice essence for surreptitious shipment to guild agents. But instead of returning to his siege, instead of going to inspect the palmeries as was expected of him, Leet headed deeper into the polar regions in search of the smugglers. Presently he stood under the dim, slanting light, trying to pick out an unevenness on the towering glacier wall that would indicate the Warren of Caves. He was pleased to see that the smugglers had made all the camouflage modifications he and Warwick had suggested. Behind the tall line of ice-impregnated rock, he would find a deep chasm, at the bottom of which lay Dominic's smuggler ships. He strode toward the base of the cliff. His hands were numb, and his cheeks burned from the cold. Since he did not know how to enter the base, he searched for a passage and hoped the refugees would see him and take him inside. But no one emerged. Leet spent an hour trying to make himself seen, even shouting and waving his arms, until finally a small opening cracked beside him, and several glaring men came out, pointing laser guns. Calmly, young Leet Kynes raised his chin in the air. "I see you're as vigilant as ever," he said sarcastically. "It looks like you need my help more than I had anticipated." As the men continued to hold their weapons on him, Leet frowned and then pointed to one pock-faced man with a missing eyebrow and another old veteran with a shock of bristly gray-white hair. "Jodam, Asuyo, do you not recognize me? I am older and taller, with a bit of a beard, but not so different than I was." "All freemen look alike," pock-scarred Jodam growled. "Then all smugglers have bad eyesight. I am here to see Dominic Vernius." Now they either had to kill him for his knowledge or take him inside. Leet marched into the tunnels, and the smugglers sealed the entrance behind him. As they passed the observation wall inside the cliff stronghold, he looked down into the chasm that sheltered their landing field. Groups of men scurried like rock ants, loading supplies into the ships. "You're preparing for an expedition," Leet said. Both veterans gave him stony looks. Asuyo, with his gray-white hair even bristlier than before, puffed his chest to display a few new cobbled-together medals and rank insignia he had added to his jumpsuit. But no one seemed impressed but him. Jodam continued to look bitter and skeptical, as if he had lost much already and expected to lose the rest soon. They took a powered lift down to the base of the crevasse and walked out into the gravel-packed basin. Leet recognized the towering figure of Dominic Vernius, his shaved scalp gleaming in the dim polar light. The smuggler leader saw the visitor's stillsuit and immediately recognized him. He waved a broad hand and strode over.
"So, lad, are you lost again? Did you have a harder time finding our place now that we have hidden ourselves better?"
"It was harder to get your men to notice me," Leet said. "Your sentries must be sleeping." Dominic laughed.
"My sentries are busy loading ships. We have a highliner to catch, docking space already reserved and paid for. What can I do for you? We are in somewhat of a hurry at the moment."
Leet drew in a deep breath. "You promised me a favor. I have come to make my request of you." Though he was taken aback, Dominic's eyes twinkled.
"Very well. Most people awaiting a payment don't take 3 years to make up their minds."
"I have many skills, and I can be a valuable member of your team," Leet said. "Take me with you." Dominic looked startled, then grinned. He clapped Leet on the shoulder with a blow hard enough to fell a herd beast.
"Step aboard my flagship and we'll talk about it."
He gestured up the ramp of a re-entry-scarred frigate. Dominic had strewn rugs and possessions around his private cabin to make the place look like home. The renegade Earl gestured for Leet to take a seat in one of the suspensor chairs. The fabric cushion was worn and stained, as if it had seen decades of hard use. But Leet didn't mind. Off to one side of Dominic's writing desk shimmered a solido hollow photo of a beautiful woman.
"Make your case, lad."
"You said you could use a freeman to tighten up security at your Seleucia Secundus base." Dominic's smooth forehead wrinkled.
"A freeman would be a welcome addition."
He turned toward the image of the beautiful woman, which shimmered as if smiling at him no matter where he moved.
"What do you think, Shando, my love? Shall we let the lad take a trip with us?"
Dominic stared at the hollow as if expecting an answer. An eerie feeling crept down Leet's spine. Then the Ixian Earl turned back to him, smiling.
"Of course we will. I made a bargain, and your request is perfectly reasonable, although one might question your sanity."
Dominic scratched a droplet of sweat at his temple.
"Anyone who wants to go to the Emperor's prison planet obviously needs a little more happiness in his life."
Leet pressed his lips together, but didn't provide details.
"I have my reasons."
Dominic didn't push the matter.
Years ago, his father had been deeply affected by what he saw on Seleucia Secundus, by the planetary scars that remained even centuries after the Holocaust.
On a quest to understand his own motivations, to set the course for his life, Leet needed to go there too. Perhaps if he spent time on Seleucia among the rugged rocks and unhealed wounds, he could understand what had sparked his father's lifelong interest in ecology. The big smuggler clasped Leet's hand in a brisk handshake.
"Very well, that's done with. What was your name again?"
"To outsiders, I am known as Weichi."
"All right, Weichi. If you are to be a member of our team, you'll have to do your share of the work."
Dominic led him out of the captain's quarters to the ramp, and then outside. Around them, smugglers sweated and grunted, out of breath.
"Before the day is out, we take off for Seleucia Secundus."
Leet
Look inside yourself, and you can see the universe. Zen Sunni Aphorism.
Arrakis, third planet in Canopus system, a most intriguing place.
Guild Navigator Demur gazed through Plaz windows from his chamber, a mere speck inside the huge Highliner. Far beneath his vessel, beyond a dirt-brown veil of wind-whipped dust, lay Arrakis, sole source of the melange that enabled him to see along the intricate pathways of the universe.
Such pleasure the spice gives me.
A tiny shuttle burned upward through the planet's atmosphere from the South Pole, broke free, and reached the great ship in orbit. When the shuttle docked, a surveillance camera showed Demur a group of passengers disembarking into the Highliner's atmospheric-controlled community areas. Though many other Spacing Guild workers crewed the vessel, as navigator, Demur had to watch all things, at all times. This was his ship, his home and workplace, his responsibility. Within his sealed chamber, the familiar hiss of orange melange gas was barely audible. In his grossly deformed body, Demur could never walk upon the desert planet, could never, in fact, leave the security of his tank. But just being near Arrakis calmed him in a primal way. With his higher-order brain, he attempted to develop a mathematical analogy for his sensation, but it would not come into clear focus. Before entering Guild service, Demur Pilru should have done more with his life while he was still human. But now it was too late. The Guild had taken him so quickly, so unexpectedly, after he'd passed their entrance examination. There'd been no time for saying proper goodbyes, for wrapping up his human affairs.
Human.
How wide a definition did the word encompass? The Bene Gesserit had spent generations grappling with that exact question, with all the nuances, the ranges of intellect and emotion, the exalted achievements, the dismal failures. Demur's physical form had altered significantly since he joined the Guild. But how much did that matter? Had he and all other navigators transcended the human condition to become something altogether different?
I am still human. I am no longer human.
He listened to his own troubled, vacillating thoughts. Through the surveillance trans eye, Demur watched the new passengers, rugged men in dark clothing, walk into the main passenger lounge. Suspensor-borne travel bags floated behind them. One of the men, ruddy-featured, with a voluminous mustache and a clean-shaven head, seemed oddly familiar.
I still remember things. Dominic Vernius. Where had he been all these years?
The navigator uttered a command into the glittering speaker globe by his tiny V-mouth. The screen showed the names of the passengers, but none was familiar. The exiled Earl Vernius was traveling under an alias, despite the Guild's absolute assurances of confidentiality. He and his companions were bound for Seleucia Secundus. A buzzer sounded inside the navigation chamber. All shuttles were secured in their berths. Guild crewmen sealed the entry hatches and monitored the Holtzman engines. An army of experts prepared the Highliner for departure from polar orbit. Demur hardly noticed. Instead, he thought of halcyon days on Ix, of the bucolic time he'd spent with his parents and twin brother in the Grand Palais of Earl Vernius. Useless detritus of the mind. As navigator, he made higher-order calculations and reveled in dimensional mathematics. He transported Highliners filled with passengers and cargo across vast distances. Yet, suddenly, he found himself blocked, distracted, unable to function. His intricate brain lost focus in the midst of precious equations. Why had his mind, the remnant of his lost self, insisted on recognizing that man. An answer surfaced, like a creature emerging from the depths of a dark sea. Dominic Vernius represented an important part of Demur Pilru's past, his human past. I want to fold space. Instead, images of bygone Ix rolled across his mind. Scenes of splendor in the Vernius court with his brother Kater. Pretty girls in expensive dresses, smiling. Even the Earl's lovely young daughter, Kylia. His brain, large enough to enfold the universe, was a storehouse of all he had been and all he would become. I have not finished evolving. The faces of the Ixian girls shifted, becoming the glowering countenances of his instructors in navigation school on Junction. Their sealed chambers clustered around his, their tiny dark eyes piercing him for his failure. I must fold space. For Demur, this was the ultimate sensual experience of his mind and body and the multiple dimensions available to him. He had given himself to the guild, much as primitive priests and nuns once gave themselves to their god, abstaining from sexual relations. Finally, he left the tiny stall point of human recollection and expanded to encompass the star systems, stretching to reach them and beyond. As Demur guided the Highliner through fold space, the galaxy became his woman, and he made love to her. Unceasing warfare gives rise to its own social conditions, which have been similar throughout the ages. One such condition is a permanent state of alertness to ward off attack. Another is the rule of the autocrat. Kamar Pilru, Ixian Ambassador in Exile, Treatise on the Downfall of Unjust Governments. For Kater, the pleasures of his life with Miral Alekhem were short-lived. Following the holoprojection of Romber, they had separated for security purposes, finding different bolt holes in which to live. They hoped to maximize the odds of at least one of them surviving and continuing their important work. By prior arrangement, they met regularly for furtive looks and muffled words in the cafeteria in which she worked. On one occasion, however, when he arrived at the appointed time, a different, dull-eyed woman stood at Miral's position in the food distribution line. He took his plate of sliced vegetable matter and sat down at the table they usually shared. Kater watched the line, but Miral did not appear. Still staring, he ate in concerned silence. Finally, when he took his empty dishes back to where workers scrubbed them for the next shift, he asked one of the food workers, "Where is the woman who was here 3 days ago?" "Gone," came the gruff answer. The older woman with a squarish face frowned. "Is that your business?" "I meant no offense." He bowed, taking one step backward. A Tleilaxu guard looked over, noticed the discussion. His rodent eyes narrowed, and Kater moved with careful steps, focused in his demeanor so that he called no further attention to himself. Something had happened to Miral, but he dared not press the issue. He could ask no one. When the guard walked over and spoke to the old food server, Kater increased his pace just enough so that he disappeared into a milling crowd, then ducked to a side shaft, descended into the subvoid tunnels, and hurried out of sight. He could feel impending doom pressing around him. Something had gone terribly wrong. They had captured Miral, and now Kater was alone again, without an organized resistance, without someone to cover for him and help in his private rebellion. Stripped of outside resources, what chance did he have? Had he been deluding himself all these years? He'd worked alone before, had sheltered his emotions, but now his heart was filled with longing for her, At times he wished he'd never gotten involved with Miral, because now he worried about her constantly. But in the quietest hours, when he lay alone in his bed, he was thankful for the moments of love they had shared. He never saw her alive again. Like angry wasps protecting a hive, the Tleilaxo instituted a brutal crackdown far more repressive than any they had previously enacted. They executed thousands of workers on mere suspicion, just to heighten their reign of terror. It soon became clear that the invaders did not care if they exterminated the entire Ixion population. They could wipe the slate clean and bring in their own people, golas, face dancers, whomever they chose. Soon the rebellious Ixion spirit was crushed all over again. Kater had not struck a blow for 6 months. In a close call, he had escaped from a Sardaukar trap only by surprising them with a handheld needle gun. Afraid the Tleilaxu might trace his fingerprints or genetic patterns, he had lived in constant fear of arrest. Nothing ever got better. After he'd projected Prince Romber's smuggled message, communication with the outside had been blocked off more vigorously than before. No observers or messages were allowed. All independent shipping captains and transportation workers were turned away. He had no way of sending even the briefest message back to Romber in exile on Caladan. Ix became little more than a black box that produced technology for Choam customers. Under Tleilaxu's supervision, much of the work was inferior, and there had been cancellations, adversely affecting sales revenues. This was only small consolation to Kater. Cut off again, he was unable to find allies, unable to steal the equipment he needed. In his new bolt hole, only a few components remained, enough that he could perhaps use his Rogo transmitter a final time or two. He would make a desperate request to his ethereal navigator brother for assistance. If nothing else, Kater vowed that someone had to know what was happening here. Miral Alakum had been his only glimmer of friendship or emotional warmth, and she had vanished from his life. He feared the worst must have happened to her. He had to transmit his message, had to find a listener. For all his enthusiasm, Romber had not been able to do enough. Perhaps Demur, with his skills as a guild navigator, could locate the long-lost Earl of Ix, Dominic Vernius. Kater's dirty clothes smelled of sweat and grease. His body had been too long without rest or decent food. Hungry, he huddled in the back of an armored storage container that held sealed crates of rejected Ixion chronometers, timepieces that could be programmed to accommodate any planet in the Imperium. The instruments had been set aside for recalibration, and had gathered dust for years. The Tleilaxu had no use for frivolous technological toys. Working under the dim light of a fading palm globe, Kater reassembled the stored components of his Rogo transmitter. He felt the ice of fear in his bloodstream. Not because he was concerned he might be caught by Tleilaxu snoopers, but because he feared the Rogo would not function. It had been a year since he'd tried to use the communications device, and this was his last set of pristine silicate crystal rods. He wiped a drop of sweat from his shaggy hair and inserted the rods into the receptacle. The battered transmitter had been repaired many times. With each use, Kater strained the jury-rigged systems, as well as his own brain, to the limit. As youths, he and his twin had shared a perfect rapport, a brotherly connection that had allowed them to complete each other's sentences, to look across the room and know what the other sibling was thinking. Sometimes his longing to recapture that empathy was almost too strong to bear. Since Demur became a navigator, the brothers had grown farther and farther apart. Kater had done his best to maintain that fragile thread, and the Rogo transmitter allowed the two minds to find a common ground. but over the years the Rogo had faltered, and finally the machine was on the verge of breaking down completely, as was Kater. He slipped in the last rod, set his jaw with determination, and activated the power source. He hoped the armored walls of the cargo container would prevent any leakage that Tleilaxu scanners could detect. After setting off his explosive wafers 2 years ago, he no longer had his scan-shielded chamber. As a result, his risks grew greater every day. Commander Garone and his Sardaukar were searching for him, and others like him, narrowing the possibilities, getting closer. Kater placed receptors against his skull, smeared on a dab of gel to improve the contact. In his mind, he tried to summon a connection with Demur, seeking the thought patterns that had once been so identical to his own. Though they still shared a common origin, Demur was vastly changed, to such a degree that the twins were now almost members of different species. He sensed a tickle in his consciousness, and then a startled but sluggish recognition. "Demur, you must listen to me. You must hear what I am saying." He felt a receptiveness in the images, and he saw in his mind the face of his brother, dark-haired, large-eyed, a snub nose, with a pleasant smile. Exactly as Kater remembered him from their days in the Grand Palais, when they had attended diplomatic functions and both had flirted with Kylie Avernius. But behind the familiar image, the startled Kater saw a strange and distorted shape, a gross, startling shadow of his brother with an enlarged cranium and stunted limbs, suspended forever in a tank of rich melange gas. Kater drove the image back and focused again on the human face of his twin, whether or not it was real. "Demur, this could be the last time we speak." He wanted to ask his brother for any news of the outside Imperium. What of their father, Ambassador Pilru, and his exile on Kaitain? If alive, the ambassador was still trying to rally support, Kater theorized. But after so many years, it would be a lost, almost pathetic cause. Kater had no time for chatting. He needed to communicate the urgency and desperation of the Ixion people. All other forms of communication had been cut off. But Demur, through his guild connections, had another outlet, a tenuous thread across the cosmos. "Someone must understand how desperate our situation is." Frantically, Kater talked at length, describing everything that Tleilaxu had done, listing the horrors inflicted by Sardaukar guards and fanatics upon the captive Ixions. "You must help me, Demur. Find someone to take up our cause in the Imperium." Romber Vernius already knew the situation, and though the prince had done what he could with secret Atreides' backing, that had not been enough. "Find Dominic Vernius. He could be our only chance. If you remember me, if you remember your human family and friends, your people, please help us. You are the only hope we have left." In front of him, only half-seeing with his eyes because his mind was so far away, stretched across the paths of fold space to his brother, Kater saw smoke curling from the Rogo transmitter. The silicate crystal rods began to shiver and crack. "Please, Demur!" Seconds later, the rods shattered. Sparks sizzled from cracks in the transmitter, and Kater tore the connectors from his temples. He jammed a fist into his mouth to cut off a scream of pain. Tears filled his eyes, squeezed out by the pressure in his brain. He touched his nose, then his ears, and felt blood leaking from ruptures inside his sinuses. He sobbed and bit his knuckles hard, but the agony was a long time subsiding. Finally, after hours of dazed pain, he looked at the blackened crystals in his transmitter and wiped the blood from his face. Sitting up and waiting for the throbbing to fade, He found himself smiling, despite his hurt and the damaged Rogo. He was sure he had gotten through this time. The future of Ix depended on what Demur could do with the information. Beneath a world, in its rocks, its dirt and sedimentary overlays, there you find the planet's memory, the complete analog of its existence, its ecological memory. Pardet Kynes, an Arrakis primer. In tight formation, armored Imperial prison ships dropped out of the Highliner hold and fell toward the festering planet like an airborne funeral procession. Even from space, Seleucus Secundus looked gangrenous, with dark scabs and a filmy cloud layer like a torn shroud. According to official press releases, new convicts sent to Seleucus had a 60% mortality rate in the first standard year. After the new cargo of prisoners and supplies had been shuttled down to guarded unloading points, Spacing Guild crewmen held the bay doors open long enough for another battered frigate and two unmarked fast lighters to emerge. Leaving no record of their passage, Dominic Vernius and his men proceeded to the planet through a gap in the satellite surveillance net. Leet Kynes sat in a passenger seat of the frigate, fingers pressed to the cool pane of the viewplaz. His eyes were as wide as those of a Freeman child on his first worm ride. Seleucus Secundus! The sky was a sickly orange, streaked by pallid clouds even in the noon brightness. Ball lightning bounced across the heavens, as if invisible titans were playing electrical ninepins. Avoiding Imperial detection beacons, Dominic's frigate skimmed across the puckered and cracked wastelands as it headed for its landing area. They crossed expanses of vitrified rock that sparkled like lakes, but were actually puddles of granite glass. Even after so many centuries, only sparse brown grass pried upward through the blasted fields, like the clawed fingers of men buried alive. Between one heartbeat and the next, Leet understood how his father had been so profoundly moved by the unhealed wounds of this forsaken place. He made a low sound in his throat. When Dominic turned toward him with a curious expression, Leet explained. In ancient times, the Zensuni people, the Freemen, were slaves here for 9 generations. Staring at the blistered landscape, he added in a quiet voice, "Some say you can still see their blood staining the soil and hear their cries carried on the wind." Dominic's broad shoulders sagged. "Waichi, Seleucus has endured more than its share of pain and misery." They approached the outskirts of a once sprawling city that now looked like an architectural scar. Stumps of buildings and blackened milk marble columns lay as detritus of the splendor that once held dominion here. Off in the scabrous hills, a new wall zigzagged around a portion of reasonably intact structures, the remains of an abandoned city that had survived the Holocaust. "That wall was meant to enclose the prison population," Dominic said. "But after it broke down and the prisoners escaped, the functionaries and administrators sealed up the barrier again and lived inside it, where they felt protected." He coughed out a snorting laugh. "Once the prisoners realized they were better off in a place where they were at least fed and clothed, they tried to break back in." He shook his shaved head. "Now the toughest ones have learned to make their own lives out here. The others just die. The Carinos imported dangerous beasts, Lhasa tigers, Seleucian bulls and the like, to keep the survivors in check. Convicted criminals are just abandoned here. No one expects to leave." Leet studied the landscape with a planetologist's eye, trying to remember everything his father had taught him. He could smell a sour dampness in the air, even in this desolate place. "Seems to be enough potential, enough moisture. There could be ground cover, crops, livestock, Someone could change this place.
The damned Carinos won't allow it.
Dominic's face darkened.
They like it this way.
As a suitable punishment for anyone who dares to defy the Imperium. Once prisoners get here, a cruel game begins. The Emperor likes to see who toughens up the best, who survives the longest. In his palace, members of the royal court place bets on renowned prisoners as to who will survive and who won't.
My father didn't tell me that, Leet said.
He lived here for years when he was younger. Dominic gave a wan smile, but his eyes remained dark and troubled.
Whoever your father is, lad, he must not know everything.
The weary exile guided the frigate above the rubble of the outer city, to a broken hangar where the roof had sagged into a spiderweb of rusted girders.
As the Earl of Ix, I prefer to be underground. No need to worry about aurora storms down there.
My father also told me about aurora storms. The frigate descended into the dark hole in the hangar and kept going down into cavernous warehouse spaces. This used to be an Imperial repository, reinforced for long-term storage. Dominic switched on the ship's running lights, splashing yellow beams into the air. A settling dust cloud looked like gray rain.
The two mismatched lighters swooped in beside the frigate and landed first.
Other smugglers emerged from within the hidden base to lock down the craft. They unloaded cargo, tools, and supplies. The pilots of the small ships hurried over to stand by the frigate ramp, waiting for Dominic to emerge. As he followed the bald leader down, Leet sniffed, still feeling naked without stillsuit or nose plugs. The air smelled dry and burned, tinged with solvents and ozone.
Leet longed for the rough warmth of natural rock, like a comfortable siege.
Too many of the walls around him were covered with artificial sheets of metal or plastone, concealing chambers beyond. On a ramp that circled the landing zone, a well-muscled man appeared. He bounded down a stairway to the ground with a smooth and feral grace, though his body was lumpy and unwieldy-looking. A startling beet-red ink-vine scar marred his squarish face, and his stringy blonde hair hung at an odd angle over his left eye. He looked like a man who had been broken and then reassembled without instructions.
Gurney Halleck!
Dominic's voice echoed in the landing chamber.
Come and meet our new comrade, born and raised among the freemen.
The man grinned wolfishly and came over with startling swiftness. He extended a broad palm and tried to crush Leet's hand with his grip. He quoted a passage that Leet recognized from the Orange Catholic Bible. Greet all those whom you would have as friends, and welcome them with your heart as well as your hand.
Leet returned the gesture, speaking a traditional Freeman response in the ancient language of Chakobsa.
Gurney comes to us from Giri Prime, Dominic said. He stowed away on a shipment bound for my old friend Duke Leto Atreides, then switched ships on Hagal, moving through commercial hubs and spaceports, until he fell in with the right comrades.
Gurney gave an awkward shrug. He was sweaty, his clothes disheveled from rigorous sword practice.
By the hells, I continued to dig myself deeper, hiding in more and more miserable places for half a year before I finally found these thugs, at the very bottom.
Leet narrowed his eyes suspiciously, ignoring the good-natured banter.
You come from Giri Prime? The Harkonnen world?
His fingers strayed toward his belt, where he kept his kris knife sheathed.
I have killed 100 Harkonnen devils.
Gurney detected the movement, but locked gazes with the bearded young freeman.
Then you and I will be great friends.
Later, when Leet sat with the smuggler band in the drinking hall of the underground base, he listened to the discussions, the laughter, the gruffly exchanged stories, the boastings and outright lies. They opened expensive bottles of a rare vintage and passed around snifters of the potent amber liquid.
"Imperial brandy, lad," Gurney said, handing a glass to Leet, who had trouble swallowing the thick liqueur.
"Shaddam's private stock, worth 10 times its weight in melange."
The scarred man gave him a conspiratorial wink.
"We swapped a shipment from Kirana, took the Emperor's personal goods for ourselves, and replaced them with bottles of skunk vinegar. I expect we'll hear about it soon."
Dominic Vernius entered the hall, and all the smugglers greeted him. He had changed into a sleeveless jerkin made of maroon mersilk lined with black whale fur. Floating like ghosts near him were several hollow images of his beloved wife, so that he could see her no matter which way he turned. It was warm and comfortable inside the stronghold, but Leet hoped to spend time outside, exploring the Seleucid landscape as his father had done. First, though, Leet had promised to use his freeman skills to study the hidden base, to help disguise it and protect it from observers, though he agreed with Dominic that few people would bother to look for a hideout here. No one willingly came to Seleucia Secundus. On the wall of his hideout mess hall, Dominic kept a centuries-old map, depicting the way this world had been in its glory days as the magnificent capital of an interstellar empire. Lines were drawn in gold metal, palaces and cities marked with jewels, ice caps made of tiger's breath opal, and inlaid seas of petrified Elakin blue wood. Dominic claimed, from his own imagination rather than any documentary evidence, that the map had belonged to Crown Prince Rafael Corino, the legendary statesman and philosopher from thousands of years ago. Dominic expressed relief that Raphael, the only good Corino of the bunch as far as he was concerned, had never lived to see what had happened to his beloved capital. All of that fairy tale magnificence, all the dreams and visions and good deeds, had been wiped away by nuclear fire. Gurney Halleck strummed his new balisette and sang a mournful song. Leet listened to the words, finding them sensitive and haunting, evoking images of bygone people and places.
"Oh, for the days of times long past, touch sweet nectar to my lips once more, fond memories to taste and feel, the smiles and kisses of delight and innocence and hope. But all I see are veils and tears, and the murky drowning depths of pain and toil and hopelessness. It's wiser, my friend, to look another way, into the light and not the dark."
Each man took his own meaning from the song, and Leet noticed tears at the edges of Dominic's eyes, while his gaze was directed at the hollow portraits of Shando. Leet flinched at the naked emotion that was so rare among the freemen.